5 points, that's all.
Note to self, you know, I try to be really good about, like, not having my work email on my phone and, like, not checking my email while I'm at home, but maybe you should. So I am supposed to defend my dissertation in May, so this is just going to be a brief overview of the projects I've done. Hopefully you guys will have some good feedback, hopefully nothing that will make me have to say that. So the central premise for my dissertation work when I came here, I spent 3 years working as an athletic trainer before coming back to get my PhD, and I worked with a surgeon that did a lot of hip scopes, and there aren't a lot of surgeons that perform these procedures or perform them well or at a high volume. And so I started noticing anecdotally that some patients did really well and some patients had a lot of postoperative pain, extended postoperative pain. They never really got back to where they wanted to be. And they couldn't really figure out why. It didn't seem to be anything obvious. It didn't have anything to do with the structure of the joint. You know, it didn't have anything to do with the joint space. It didn't have anything to do with how big their labral tear was. It didn't seem to have anything to do with how they were doing functionally or in physical therapy. So when I came back to get my PhD, that was my question when I got here, is why do some people still hurt? That was the question I wanted to answer. So just a little bit of background on the population I work with. More or less, tabular impingement is an anatomic incongruence between the ball and the socket and hip. There are technically three different types. This is what we call a pincer lesion. So it's an extension of the acetabulum. And this is what we call a cam lesion. So it's a bump on the femoral head. And as you can imagine, when you go into certain positions, specifically like a flexion internal rotation position, these two bones, if there's extra bone in either location or both, some people have a combined lesion, it pinches the structures in between. So the capsule, the labrum, which is the cartilage ring surrounding the acetabulum, those tissues get damaged. So you can see cysts start to form inside the bone, tears to the labrum, and adhesions start to form in the capsule, all of which cause pain. So, generally speaking, the patients we see with these conditions are young and active. So we know that this condition is exacerbated by activity. So it's much more common in military members, in athletes, or I should say, symptomatic FAI is much more common in these populations. Similar to, let's say, a bulging disc in your back. We know a lot of asymptomatic people have a bulging disc, but it seems to be exacerbated in patients that are active and therefore, you know, going into those symptomatic positions more often. So that's the population. So what's the problem? Not everyone becomes symptomatic, like I just said. So 70% of asymptomatic people just walking around have a tear to their labrum. Why some become symptomatic and some do not become symptomatic is still a question we're trying to answer. There is an increased burden on the healthcare system because of this population. Hip scopes have increased 18-fold from 1999 to 2009. It continues to increase. There are a lot of surgeons performing these procedures that maybe are not qualified to do so, which is kind of terrifying, because there's a really, really steep learning curve. You know, some procedures surgeons can perform and learn fairly easily. Hip scopes are really challenging because you have to keep the leg in traction the entire time. So if you take too long, a lot of patients then have nerve issues, they lose sensation, or a lot of them come in and are numb, and places they wouldn't like to be numb. So there's a sharp learning curve to the procedure. Time to treatment. So recent systematic reviews have put the average time of duration of symptoms upwards of 28 to 32 months from the onset of symptoms until the patients get in the right hands. And this really comes back to the fact that there aren't a lot of surgeons well trained in this procedure. So these people come into the doctor, even in orthopedic, and they complain of anterior hip pain, groin pain, maybe some snapping or popping, and they often get misdiagnosed. They have a hip flexor strain, they have snapping hip syndrome, they have and these other things, and then they're treated for those, and their pain doesn't go away. So they bounce around from provider to provider, never really dealing with the core issue. So my thought was, well, these patients are in pain for a really long time. Perhaps they're developing some maladaptive coping strategies. So I'll go into those a little bit more. And then, like I started with, a subset of these patients, somewhere between 20 and 25%, the literature is inconsistent, have persistent postoperative pain following this procedure. So in the procedure, we fix the anatomy. They shave the bone off, they clear the impingement, they either debride or repair the labrum. Your anatomy's fixed, right? You should no longer be having pain, in theory. So my question is, why are some people still having pain? So that leads us to this issue of acute versus chronic pain. Some patients come in and they get in the right hands right away, and so they've only had pain for a few months. Whereas other people, I have patients in my dissertation study that have been in pain for up to 10 years. So that leads us into this chronic pain cycle, and that can lead to neurologic adaptations to pain. So acute pain is a normal response to injury. You hurt something, you feel pain. Normal tissue healing in the literature is 3 to 6 months. By 6 months, tissue should be healed, theoretically. So if pain is still present in the absence of tissue injury, then it becomes its own disease state. So this is when people get diagnosed with chronic low back pain, things like that. And chronic pain, really, in the literature and in the textbooks, is defined as a disease of the brain, because it really has to do with the way we process pain and the neurologic adaptations to chronic pain. So that brings me to central sensitization. This is one of the key premises for my dissertation work. So what central sensitization is it's characterized by a hypersensitive response to nociception. I don't know how much neuro anyone else has had, but nociception is basically how we feel pain. So central sensitization, it can be an oversensitivity, a decreased inhibition, and or an increased synaptic activity. It can be one of those, it can be all of those. They're hard to measure as individual premises, so oftentimes it's just characterized as all of the above. It occurs at the nociceptive levels. We have nociceptors located in our tissues. It can occur at the dorsal root ganglion and or the thalamus. So we measure it in different places because it can occur at different levels of the nervous system. So just as sort of a refresher, nociceptors are free nerve endings that are located in your tissues, and their purpose is to notify the brain of potential danger. So just because your nociceptors are activated or sending messages to your brain doesn't necessarily mean you're going to feel pain. So think of things like Kevin Ware, when his tibia was literally sticking out of his leg. He said he didn't feel pain, right? So you're thinking, oh, your nociceptors have to be firing. There's clear tissue damage, but that doesn't correlate with the pain you feel. There are other studies where, there's this one interesting study that Dr. Andriotta tells in neuroplasticity, where a gentleman had stepped on a nail, and it was coming out the top of his shoe. And he goes to the ER and he's screaming in pain, and they literally have to sedate him in order to remove this nail. So they go and they take his shoe off, and the nail had actually gone between his toes. So it wasn't even puncturing his skin. But the image or the thought that it was puncturing his skin had put him in his brain had decided there's a real threat, so he was feeling pain. So you have to keep in mind that tissue damage and pain are not correlated. So the way that we measure these concepts in the clinical setting are pain pressure thresholds and temporal summation. So I use, it's called a pressure algometer, and I push it onto the ipsilateral hip and the contralateral forearm, trying to get different sides of the body and also somewhere proximal to the site, because if I irritate the dorsal root ganglion at this level, I want to make sure that I'm clear of that to measure it at a different level. So pain catastrophizing is another variable that I found in the literature that I was really curious and thought perhaps was affecting the way these people were processing pain. It's very different than central sensitization, but it's been shown in other populations, like total joints and rotator cuffs, to affect the way people process and cope with pain. So it's a psychosocial construct, which put me way out of my comfort zone, because I was stepping into this psychological world that I was wildly uncomfortable with. But basically, when people are pain catastrophizers, they adopt this set of behaviors that are present in response to actual or anticipated pain. So they don't even have to actually be in pain. It could be the thought of anticipated pain, and they display these behaviors. So in acute populations, Emily was part of a study we did a few years ago with Dr. Latterman with these ACL patients. And we found that in acute pain populations, these fluctuate with tissue damage. So it makes sense. I injure my knee. I tear my ACL. I'm thinking about it all the time, right? So it's all I'm thinking about. I'm ruminating on it. I can't go on with my life. Life is over. But then as I start to get better and I start going through rehab and I can do my activities of daily living, I start to think about it less and less. So there's a natural response in acute injuries. In chronic pain populations, though, like patients with FAI, these behaviors are considered more static, and they can actually be predictive of how people are going to do. It has been correlated with increased opioid use, a loss of self-determination, increased disability, all these other things in other populations. So I wanted to examine this in patients with FAI. So I like to think about it. I'm sort of coming at this issue from two different sides. Is it a hardware issue? Is it literally something that's changing in the way people are processing pain from a neurologic perspective? Or is it a software issue? Does it have to do with the social context in which people are coping with their pain? So both of these variables have been proven in the literature to be modifiable with appropriate interventions. So that is a positive thing. I would hate to identify a variable that's leading to increased postoperative pain and then be like, sorry about it. We can't help you. So my first project, this one's done, and it was just a retrospective chart review. Basically, I just wanted to compare patients and clinical factors between patients with and without depression and anxiety, because depression and anxiety have very similar neurologic pathways, and both lead to increased systemic inflammation. So we run into this a lot when we look at biomarkers, because we have increase in the interleukins when we have depression and anxiety, but we also have an increase in the interleukins when we have tissue damage. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What's that?
I also want to be this.
Great, thank you. So I wanted to look and see, you know, what comes first? Are these patients depressed and then they get injured? Or then they have pain, or do they have pain and then the depression sets in? And also, what other variables differ between these groups? So the aim of the study was to compare the pre-op presentation of these patients with and without anxiety or depression, undergoing hip scopes in terms of their duration of symptoms, previous surgeries, and concomitant diagnoses. Secondarily, I wanted to examine these characteristics between patients that had a long duration of symptoms and short duration of symptoms. Because right now, in the FAI world, everyone's screaming, duration of symptoms, duration of symptoms. They're in pain for so long. This has to be the problem. So I really wanted to be able to answer that question. So what I found was that depression and anxiety are extremely common, at least among the patients that we see here at UK. The national averages are around 5%. So about 5% of the population is diagnosed with depression, about 5% of the population is diagnosed with anxiety. In our patients, and granted there's a limitation to this because some of it's self-reported. So it's either self-reported or it's, you know, noted in their medical chart. I pulled from either. But either way, patients are telling us or they have been diagnosed by a clinician that they have anxiety or depression. And the frequency did not differ based on duration of symptoms. So I thought that was really interesting as well. Patients with depression and anxiety had more concomitant diagnoses. So the most common concomitant diagnoses were like fibromyalgia, chronic low back pain, migraines. Those all kind of make sense. And they also had an increased healthcare utilization. So moving forward, these projects are in the works, but my second project is looking at the preoperative relationship between central sensitization, pain catastrophizing, and their duration of symptoms. So what's the interplay between these variables? And then my third project is a pre-post, so I'm looking at patients before surgery and after surgery, about 3 months after surgery, and I'm looking to see if there's a relationship between increased post-surgical pain and the variables I've been talking about this entire time. I wanted to run regression, see like which of these variables would be predictive of post-operative pain, and then I realized I'd be here for 600 years, because I don't have enough people to appropriately power that analysis, because I have a lot of variables, so I would be here forever. I'll probably still run it just for funsies. But.
Couldn't you decrease your variables and make it look?
Yeah, I could. But then I'd be afraid I'd miss something, right? Like, what if it's a variable I didn't account for? I don't know. It's a balance, right? So, I don't know. We'll see. But I powered it this way. So I need 70 people. I currently have just over 30, so we're getting there. But we're seeing some pretty big effects. So my preliminary analysis, I haven't looked at any of the postoperative data yet, but pain catastrophizing does tend to be higher for those patients that have had a really long duration of symptoms. It wasn't statistically significant, but it's definitely trending that way. And this also is trending towards being significant. The number of people who scored, so 19 is the threshold we use on the fake catastrophizing scale to say that someone is displaying these behaviors. And it was also longer, there were more patients who had severe catastrophizing in the long duration of symptoms group. So there does seem to be a relationship between how people are contextualizing and dealing with their pain and how long they've been in pain, which makes sense but hasn't been shown yet in the literature. So that's where I'm at. To be continued. Any feedback? Hi, Em.
Hi. I know your method, so you're using the pressure algometer, but
yes.
You're also using the Von Frey filaments, right? So have you seen a difference between the pressure algometer versus the Von Frey? Or like, I don't like the Von Frey filaments.
Yeah, I know. So the Von Frey filament is basically just like a little
filament,
little poker, and we poke it on the contralateral middle finger, the middle phalanx, and poke it once, say rate this on a scale from 0 to 10, and then poke them again for 30 seconds and have them rate it again. The idea is this idea of temporal estimation, so this wind-up. So in people that don't have the ability to modulate pain appropriately, they feel pain, and then it gets worse and worse and worse and worse because their brain isn't able to say, that's not a threat. So in a normal patient, they would realize this isn't a threat, and their pain would either stay the same or decrease. Whereas in someone who doesn't have the mechanism or the ability to recognize this as it's not a threat, their pain increases. It has been shown in total knees to be the best predictor, as far as the systematic review goes, of postoperative pain as far as processing pain from a neurologic perspective. I'm not finding that so far. I'm also not finding that the pain pressure thresholds are very useful because they don't seem to be changing.
My follow-up is also, do you think that potentially you're a little bit biased because you know what, like if someone responds to you doing the Von Frey and they say either this gets worse or it stays the same, mm-hmm. you then know what that means. So do you think that maybe
probably
you could have introduced a little bit of bias?
Sure. I mean, absolutely.
Or if you get maybe somebody else to do that test.
Yeah.
And they don't know it.
It'd be great to be able to have like a student or someone else collect the data who's sort of blinded to what the results mean. I'm not that lucky. but no, it's definitely, absolutely a problem. And, you know, there's a lot of variables that play into that.
Yeah. How do you select your Von Frey here to use for your subjects? Do you use the same one for everyone?
I do use the same one, so they're measured in, like, the grams of pressure that they're exerting. So in the literature, you're supposed to select one that when it hits the skin, it bends, so you know you're exerting enough pressure. So really it has more to do with how much pressure I'm applying than the patient themselves. So I selected one that I know every time I hit down, I can make the filament bend. That's what's been done in the literature. They seem to be consistent. They select one and then stick with it. It's probably not the best.
When the animal models, we start with the easiest one, so it bends, right? And it bends, that means you applied enough pressure, you know what it is. It doesn't hurt, it's a stiffer one, Then the one that hurts is the one that...
Oh, that's a good idea.
And then if you're more sensitive, obviously, the one that bends earlier,
Right. And so they have a decreased threshold. So that's interesting. That's a really good idea. There are other ways to measure pain processing in humans that I didn't include. So there are ones where they do, you know, like try to stimulate the gait control theory. So they'll put one hand in an ice bucket and then test the other side. So the theory would be in people that are processing pain normally, their nervous system's being overrided by the larger fibers that are being activated when your hand's in the bucket. And so your pain pressure threshold would increase. You can withstand more pain because you're not... your brain isn't actually receiving those messages. Whereas when you don't have your hand in the bucket, your pain pressure threshold would be lower. I didn't do that kind of stuff because I didn't want to deal with ice water, hot water. They do it with blood pressure cuffs. There's a lot of really cool ways to do it, but I'm in a clinic. So if I were in a lab, it'd be a lot easier to have access to those types of things. But when I'm pulling patients as they're like scheduling surgery, I don't want to be like, hey, stick your hand in this bucket of water.
Your patient population is difficult too.
Oh, they're a hot mess.
Having worked with them, it's really, they're very weary of anything that, because they've been in pain for so long, and Duncan's like their last hope. So anything that you're doing that they think could derail any of that.
Oh yeah, people. I've had a lot of people say no.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot to mention, I excluded people who had any neurologic conditions, so fibromyalgia, any CP, I mean anything. It is. With my population or in general? My population? My population is mainly middle-aged women. So 30-year-old, 35-year-old women. I think I have like 5 men. And that's consistent across the literature. It's generally middle-aged women.
Is it because of
what leads them to be injured?
That's a great question. I don't know why they start having pain. Because we know that a lot of people have this condition. 70% of the people in this room have a torn labrum. That doesn't mean we're all in pain. What makes them symptomatic, I don't know.
And then, like, similar, I guess, you showed, like, a massive increase in the amount
of
procedures
going on. Yeah. Why? I think part of it is just education. We now know what it is. I think we're going to see a pullback. I think it's sort of like when... A long time ago, Dr. Ull had mentioned this, you know, we started like decompressing everyone's shoulder and then realized it wasn't actually helping everyone. I think eventually when we have enough literature to say, oh, it's actually how these people are conceptualizing pain and they think pain equals tissue damage and so therefore they're avoiding all of these things and then they're starting to get muscular adaptations and blah, blah, blah. I think the answer for a lot of these people is appropriate physical therapy, but a lot of physical therapists don't know how to appropriately treat this. So the biggest thing that I think, and this is just anecdotal, is causing these patients pain is all of the anterior capsule adhesions and the inflammation to the, inflammation is not the right word, the irritation to the hip flexor. So I think if physical therapists did appropriate joint mobilizations and things like that, instead of just purely strengthening, I think that patients would see a lot better outcome. So I think we're going to see a pullback. I think that right now it's like the hot topic and everyone's getting operated on. But I think we're going to see that we're not selecting the appropriate patients. Not everyone needs to get operated on because some people don't do well after surgery.
Yeah.
So that's not the right option for them. But those are good questions and I wish I had answers. I'm not sure.
Women have more range of motion than men, so that's why you see the higher female incidence because we have a more likelihood that our phone will come in contact with something
Well, women's hips are generally weaker.
Yeah.
More women walk with that Trendelenburg type gait, which adds extra
large carrying
and adductor, stronger adductor moment.
But do you think it had anything to do with birthing?
Could. I hadn't considered that, but that could definitely have something to do with it. I think
just the birthing process, but isn't it, I don't know if this is folklore, if it's real, isn't some people that, you know, went through birthing, they have a different pain threshold, or is that still...
I think I've heard that. I haven't actually looked at the literature. I would believe it. But nowadays, so many women have epidurals, changing that. But I think sex, too. Like, we've done a lot of work looking at... which is really, always really comfortable. Looking at, because it's honestly one of the biggest complaints when people come in, is that they have pain having sex, especially women.
Yeah.
And so I think that that, too, is probably something that's aggravating the condition. Don't worry, things work better after surgery. Hi, Joel.
Is there a greater occurrence of osteoarthritis after?
So the theory, there's not any literature to prove this yet. The theory is, let's say, so this labral tears have been shown to be a simulator of osteoarthritis. So people that have labral tears, they get osteoarthritis earlier and it progresses faster. We don't know if this intervenes and slows the process or accelerates the process. So the theory is if you, let's say you had a labral tear and you were going to get osteoarthritis that and you needed a total hip tear. the theory that surgeons say is that, okay, you have a labral tear, we intervene, now maybe you'll need a total hip here. That's their theory. It hasn't been shown yet. But it kind of makes sense. I mean, you remove the irritant to the joint. The other interesting thing is that in the literature, the outcomes from just debriding the labrum and repairing the labrum are no different. So you have an extended non-weight-bearing time, you have an extended rehabilitation if you repair it, whereas if you just debride it, the outcomes aren't any different. And I think part of that, unlike the shoulder, is that the labrum, the purpose of the labrum and the hip is really just to have a fluid seal, to lock in the pressure within the joint. It doesn't add any stability because the hip's already so inherently stable. Unlike the shoulder, the labrum actually serves a purpose of adding additional stability. So I think that's probably why you don't see that in the hip.
Do you think it could be the opposite, like what we see with the knee when you do an ACL reconstruction and now we're inciting osteoarthritis?
Could be.
That's a potential. Because now yeah. You've broken the synovial capsule. You've
right.
Changed the entire.
Could be. But this is what we're telling all the patients, so hopefully not.
I know. I've given that spiel.
So they don't inject like corticosteroids?
They do.
So, okay.
So that is usually, so part of the reason that patients have pain for so long is it's really hard to diagnose. Because so many things refer pain to the hip. Is it your low back? Is it your SI joint? Is it like an adductor pathology? Is it, you know, osteitis pubis? Where is the pain coming from? So the way that we definitively diagnose that, because a lot of people have FAI and not pain. Right, so we need to make sure that that's the pain generator. And so the way we do that is we inject corticosteroid into the joint. So if you have pain relief, that means that your pain generator is in the hip. It's the labrum or it's cartilage damage or whatever. If you have no relief, then even though you're having pain in your hip, that's not what's causing the problem. Yeah.
They do other long-term therapies such as like capsaicin treatments to kind of take away the pain reception completely?
No, not yet. We're not there yet. Be cool though.
That'd be neat.
Yeah. There's a lot of really, I mean, I like get giddy talking about this. I don't know. I love the hip. I think it's such a cool joint. But there's so much we don't know. Like, we literally still publish articles that say, like, outcomes after hip arthroscopy. Can you imagine a paper that said, like, outcomes after knee arthroscopy? Like, it's such a, we're not even based on, like, procedure. It's so new that people are just, like, grouping everything together. So it's really hard to interpret the results. Because they're not even saying, like, ACL, meniscus.
And it's hard because every surgeon, it's hard to even compare across surgeons because if you shave the bone down even a millimeter farther than I guess you should have, it completely changes how they do. And so every surgeon is going to do their procedure differently. Every surgeon's going to, you know, some surgeons will recommend like an entire tibial osteotomy where some surgeons are comfortable just shaving down the lesions, so it's hard to compare even in this patient population because everything is so different.
It's such a specialized procedure, too, because if you shave in the wrong spot, you'll cut off the blood supply of the head of the femur.
Yeah.
And then they'll have AVM in like a week.
Yikes.
Then they need a hip replacement.
Right.
So that's fun.
Wow.
Yeah. Any like feedback on like this wasn't clear? I have my claws on Friday. Anything I could have explained better?
No, but your arthroscopy and your tennis club is for stony companies.
Perfect.
You're going to use this again someplace.
Thanks, Tim.
Great. No, that's wonderful. I'm really
good. I didn't know.
I don't know what you're going to do. Maybe we'll just get in an hour. Just one of
the yeah, yeah, that's very good. Super helpful. I should probably take Ron Swanson off, too.
Yeah. I think you should use the other quote. It's time to stop half-assing two things or full-assing one.
I love him. He kind of reminds me. You remind me of him. Got a little Ron Swanson in you.
Very good. Very good.